any asset that has a predictable cash flow or a cash flow has a known value. It's not based on emotions. It's not based on the war in the Middle East or the mood on Wall Street. It is based on facts. As we mature more, we want to get away from speculating and move toward investing. You know, investing is when your principal is generally safe and you've got a chance to make a profit. Speculating is when your principal is not at all safe.
Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings, the number one show about growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. Now, here's your host, Mark Allen Kenny.
Hey everybody, welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings. I'm Mark Allen Kenny. Our guest today is Paul Moore. How you doing today, Paul?
I'm doing great, Mark. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you for being here. Paul is a managing partner at Wellings Capital. His firm has invested in over 17,000 self-storage, mobile home park, and multifamily units across the U.S. for a total value of over $500 million. Paul completed over 85 real estate investments and exits. He's appeared on HGTV's House Hunters. He's rehabbed and managed dozens of rental properties and built a number of new homes. And Paul is the host of the podcast, How to Lose Money. Paul, thanks so much for being here today. I really appreciate you taking the time. Could you tell the listeners just a little bit more about how you got started in real estate?
Yeah. So I sold my company in 1997 to a publicly traded firm in Detroit. And my family moved to the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, trying to raise our two kids, which later turned into four kids. And they weren't cloned. But anyway, I know it sounded that way when I said it, which is really bizarre. But at any rate, in 2000, my friend and I had heard that you could buy houses for a fraction of their value at the courthouse steps. So we spent a day or two researching how to do that. We went to the courthouse steps. We were the only people there. We bought a house for about half of its value. We flipped it in weeks. And we said, this is easy. And we thought we could do it every couple weeks, you know, like we could do 25 houses a year. And of course, people scale up and do much more than that. But we soon found it was harder than we thought. But we started flipping houses, started flipping waterfront lots at a resort called Smith Mountain Lake. I built an online marketing portal that's still there that generates leads for realtors. And I did a subdivision. And I'll tell you more about the subdivision later in the show. But I always was wondering, how do you get into commercial real estate? You know, it seems like that's where the big money people are. And actually was launched into that without even knowing it. In 2010 and 11, we'd invested in some oil and gas deals in North Dakota and found out there was no housing for the oil workers there. And so we went and built a large, very nice multifamily project in the middle of the North Dakota wilderness to house oil workers. And we owned and operated that for years. At the end of that time, I ended up writing the book called The Perfect Investment about multifamily investing. And that's how I got started.
Wow, that's amazing. So I think one of the things I'd love to talk about, and I found really interesting learning about your background, was kind of your, what you call the riches to rags story, where you, I think the numbers is you had about $1.5 million in the bank and then went to 2.5 in debt and then back to debt free in 13 months. Could you talk a little bit about the story behind that and what exactly happened?
Yeah. So, you know, there's something we want to do as we mature more. We want to get away from speculating and move toward investing. You know, investing is when your principal is generally safe and you've got a chance to make a profit. Speculating is when your principal is not at all safe and you've got a chance to make a profit. And so when we threw, you know, about $1 million cumulatively between about seven friends in the bottom of a hole in the ground in North Dakota, hoping for 10 or 100 times as much profit from oil, that was speculating in many ways. When friends of mine invested in Bitcoin, some made money, some lost. That was speculating because there's not an income stream associated with that. Well, you can speculate in real estate as well. And I bought a 5-acre piece of land that was very valuable in a waterfront area at Smith Mountain Lake in Virginia. And I was speculating in the sense I was counting on the county to run a public road in front of it so I could divide it into 5 1-acre lots. I had very little research and more money than sense behind me. This was about 15 years ago in 2005. Well, the county didn't make that gravel road into a public road, and I was stuck with this. In late 2007, I had $2.5 million in debt, exactly 10 years after I had made all that money selling my company. And I found myself, my business partner abandoned me. He basically said, look, I can't pay half this interest anymore. He legitimately couldn't. So he left and said, look, you can have all the assets and the debt. And I didn't know what to do. And so I tried this morning meditation, devotional time, and I was journaling, and I was like, what would George Mueller do? Now, George Mueller is this guy in England who was this hellion in Germany who became a saint in England, and he basically took care of what turned out to be a total of about 10,000 orphans in his lifetime over the whole 1800s. But he basically had strong opinions on how you should operate your life, and he didn't believe in debt, but he also did really, really outrageous things that succeeded. And so I thought, what would George Mueller do? I had just read his biography. I believed he would start giving his way out of debt. So I called a couple friends and my family together, and I said, look, we're right on the edge of bankruptcy. We're going to give our way out of debt. And that made a lot of sense.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
What I meant by it was on January 1st, 2008. Now, keep in mind, we know 2008 as the great financial crisis, but at the time we didn't. We didn't know how bad it was going to get. We'd hoped that the little bubble and the bursting we'd seen in 2006 and 7 was the end of it. Well, of course, the worst of it hadn't even nearly started. So January 1st, 2008, our family said, look, we're going to start giving a set amount to charity, to organizations that we care about, to our church, and we're going to see what happens. Because I believe, you know, in whatever you reap, whatever you sow, you'll reap. And some people call it karma, you know, in other parts of the world, and more so than in the United States, that is. And at any rate, we started giving. And about 4 weeks later, I had this chance meeting with a real estate developer. I told him about this 5-acre non-subdivision. And he said, you know, if you did this, you might be able to subdivide that land. And I said, no, that wouldn't work. And without getting to the detail of what that was, I said, no, that wouldn't work. He said, you ought to think about it. And at that moment, I had this amazing light bulb moment. And I realized, wait a minute, I know how I could do this. So 2 days later, I was in front of the Planning and Zoning Commission of the county. And I said, hey, look, I want to subdivide this land using your law that doesn't allow subdivision. But here's the twist on it. And the lady looked at me and shook her head, and she said, I've been working in this job for decades, and no one has ever come up with such an outrageous plan to circumvent this law. But then she smiled and she said, but you did. She said, you figured out something no one else has ever apparently thought of. And yes, you can do this. I can't stop you. So I would approve this. So we ended up, there was a lot more work, a lot of surveyors and septic inspections and county approvals and lawyers involved. But 13 months later, we had subdivided all the lots, sold 4 of the 5 right in the worst months of the Great Recession in the fall of 2008. And we were completely debt-free. We even paid off our house.
Wow, that's amazing. What can I just ask really quickly what that strategy or solution was that you kind of, you know, figured out?
Mark, you're a real estate guy. I knew you'd ask. it's quite involved, but I'll tell you the quick summary. There's a law, especially in rural places, that says you can gift a family member a piece of your land. And so think about this. Imagine a farmer with 160 acres, let's say in Illinois, and they want to gift 5 acres off the road, let's say, you know, 100, 200 yards down a driveway. They want to gift 5 acres or even 1 acre to an aging parent, in-law, or a child who's trying to get started. And the law says you can do what's called a family exemption or a family subdivision. So the thing is, when you give an acre to somebody like that, they have to hold it for 5 years minimum. And that's why the plan my friend suggested wouldn't work. I said, look, you'd have to hold it for 5 years minimum. And so that means it would take me 20 years to subdivide these, make these 4 subdivisions to make five lots because I could only do one of those every 5 years. Well, what I didn't realize, what I realized actually on that fateful day, was the parent tract, in other words, the 160 acres in my Illinois farming analogy, the parent tract wouldn't have to wait 5 years. They could gift that acre or 5 acres to that in-law or child, and then they could immediately sell the, quote, parent tract. That's what I realized. And so, and this is hard to follow, but here's what we did. So the first person in this line of five buyers, we had to line up for the five buyers to make this work. The first person in line bought the whole 5 acres from me for, in each tract, each 1 acre tract was worth about $350, okay? He bought the whole thing for, let's say, just for quick math sake, $1.6 million. He gifted an acre to his wife, the acre he wanted to keep, and then he immediately sold the 4 acres for, let's say, $1.2 million to the second person in line. That person in line gifted an acre to his wife, and then he sold the other 3 acres for $900,000. That person did the same, and then the last person, and then we had one lot left over. But that series of events is how this happened. We had to get a bank to approve a loan, an 80 or whatever percent loan on this first sale of like $1.6 million when the land was only worth $800,000 in and of itself. And the bank actually agreed to do this. Amazing. And the person trusted me enough to take this, get this loan.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say that's quite a story. I mean, it takes a lot of coordination and trust between all the parties involved. So that's pretty extraordinary.
Oh, I can't even believe that this happened in August and September of 2008 when people were not, number one, not buying waterfront lots. Number two, when banks were refusing to do loans. I mean, it's just amazing to me when I think back on it and I just see the hand of providence all over it.
Yeah, yeah. I want to go back to what you said a few minutes ago about, you know, speculation versus investments. And yeah, as we change or, you know, get older or even change kind of our goals, I personally don't like to speculate at all. But could you talk about kind of how, what your strategy is these days? And I know that you've done self-storage and multifamily and all kinds of different projects. What's kind of your strategy today and your thoughts behind a good solid investment where your principal is safe?
So there's an amazing formula. I call it the value, the commercial real estate leverage formula. I made that up. And it's the value formula that everybody in commercial real estate knows. You're well aware of it. And that is that the value of the asset is the net operating income divided by the cap rate. And so any cash flowing asset with predictable cash flow has an inherent value. It's not based on comps. It's not based on appraisal. It's based on the cash flow and the cap rate. And so because of that, any asset that has a predictable cash flow or a cash flow has a known value. It's not based on emotions. It's not based on the war in the Middle East or the mood on Wall Street. It is based on facts. And so an asset that has predictable cash flow, like a, let's say, a 20-unit apartment building that has a net operating income of, let's say, X, and let's say you divide that by a cap rate, which is the normal rate of return with no leverage for that asset in that market at this time, that is a value. And so what it's doing is by getting assets like this, you're creating true wealth, Mark. True wealth, in my mind, is assets that produce income. And so although I'm not knocking it, I'm not knocking Bitcoin or gold or silver or oil, they're speculative in nature because they're not assets that have a regular income stream attached to them. And so that's what I'm talking about when I want to invest in true wealth generating assets now.
Sure, sure. That makes sense. And can we talk a little bit specifically about kind of the different asset classes of real estate and just your thoughts on, you know, self-storage versus multifamily? I know that you've done multifamily in the past, and it seems like you've pivoted a little bit because of where the market's at. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So we love multifamily because it's recession resistant. If you look at the foreclosure rate in the downturn of multifamily, even though it was the greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression, the foreclosure rate was very small. In fact, it was 10% of the foreclosure rate on homes. Some people say it was even as low as 5% at the worst part of the Great Recession. And since then, it's dropped to a fraction of 1% of the foreclosure rate on houses. And I'm talking large-scale multifamily here. I'm not talking about a duplex or a triplex. I'm talking about a large-scale multifamily, the kind of stuff that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae sometimes, you know, does the lending on. And so we love multifamily because of low foreclosure rates. You can look down the road and see the demographics. You've got lots of people, you know, baby boomers, millennials, Gen Z, immigrants, four classes of people who are growing, all growing in renting multifamily. So we love multifamily for that reason. We love self-storage because it's recession resistant. People typically, you know, they can put up with a price increase. If you increase an apartment by 10%, chances are someone might move rather than pay an extra, let's say, $100 a month for that apartment. But if you increase a self-storage unit that's on a month-to-month lease by 10%, well, chances are that's only $10 a month by comparison. Chances are they're not going to spend a Saturday, load up a U-Haul, get their friends together to move their junk, their treasures down the street just to save $10, especially when their impression is, I'm not going to be here that long anyway. So it's not super sensitive to price increases. People typically don't move once they're in a storage facility for quite some time. I like mobile home parks as well. It's very hard and very, very costly to move a mobile home. And so mobile home parks have tenants that typically last, from what I understand, an average of 13 years. These people are cooperating. They're partnering with the mobile home park because they typically own the home. The park owns the dirt under the home. And so they typically get a better cooperation because, you know, the people have to do their own maintenance. They have to keep it up themselves. So that's the kind of mobile home parks we love to invest in. There are other asset classes like cell towers. Very hard to find a way to invest in those. Cell tower land. My son invests in large farmland and timberland, and he's doing really, really well with that. There's, senior living, which I think is quite certain types of senior living are quite recession resistant as well. Of course, we have malls, hospitality, retail, and some of those type of commercial asset types that are really, really hurting right now, as we all know.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. So, Paul, I also wanted to ask you kind of something that I learned about you before this interview is just your drive to be, you know, you kind of told the story of how you learned to, you solve that problem by giving away land. And I know one of your companies is set up to fight human trafficking, and you're a big believer in finding your why and having a purpose. Yeah. Why do you think that's so important for investors and business owners to find their why?
Great question. You know, when I sold my company for almost $3 million in 1997 with a partner, we split that. I woke up on October 7th, 1997, no different than I was the day before. Even though I had all this money in my bank account, I was no happier and I was no more fulfilled. And I mean, I was happy that I had that opportunity to do that, real happy, but it didn't actually in a deep, deep way changed my life. And I already knew this at the time, but it really imprinted on me the real need for fulfillment in other ways. You know, we're designed for relationships. We're designed to help and care about others. So it just reminded me that I want to be a person who has a big purpose in life. About 5 years ago, someone asked me what I knew about human trafficking. And I said, I think that's something terrible that happens in the Philippines and India and all this. I didn't know how bad it really was. Mark, did you know if you took the record, not the average, the record profits from Apple, General Motors, Nike, and Starbucks, you added those record profits together, doubled that number, that's the approximate annual revenues generated annually by human trafficking.
Wow, and I did not know that.
It's stunning. And I like to believe that if I was alive in the 1800s, I would have been fighting against slavery. And I'd like to believe if I was an adult in the 1960s, I'd be fighting for civil rights. Well, this is a civil right. This is slavery, and it's happening right under our noses. So for those of you who are looking for something to get behind, something to fight, something that everybody in theory would hate, human trafficking would be one of many great causes to consider.
Sure. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that. Do you have any advice of how an investor can find their why, whether it's, you know, a cause to get behind, or how did you kind of go down that path to realize, you know, I need to put more purpose behind what I'm doing? Do you have any advice for how a person can kind of implement that in their own life?
Yeah, that is, it's really important to figure that out. It's one of the ways to do that is to get some time alone. To get some time journaling, considering. There's a book by Bob Goff called Dream Big, G-O-F-F, and he talks about this exact thing, how to find your big why, your big purpose in life. You need to get some time alone to think about, what am I good at? What am I not so good at? What dreams did I have as a younger person that I put on the shelf to pursue my career or whatever? What is nudging inside of me? What do I need to do to fulfill the purpose that I was put on the earth for? And so doing some journaling, getting some feedback from some people close to you on what you're good at, looking at, you know, so I know of a guy who was a lawyer and he did that. He called it his day job. He made a lot of money at this day job, but he used it to fund his real passion, which was fighting human trafficking and doing things like that. So one of the great things we can do is just, again, get some time, journal, really think about it, see where your heart comes alive, you know, and that might be in the middle of your business somehow, or it might be like the lawyer who just considered that his day job, where in the evenings and weekends, he really fought, you know, he did what he was passionate about.
It's that time in the show for a segment called Best Deal, Worst Deal, where we talk about real estate transactions that you've done in the past so that others can learn from your knowledge and expertise. So, Paul, with that said, what's the best real estate deal that you've done?
Well, the best real estate deal I've done was actually, I realized I only had 24 hours in a day. I realized I had a very limited team of people around me that have very limited knowledge. And so for us, when we decided to expand from multifamily only to self-storage and mobile home parks, we realized the best way to do that for us would be to find the very best operators in the space that we could find and to invest heavily with them. So we're actually, we've become a due diligence company that looks for the very best operators, the very best deals, and we invest heavily with them. And so the Wellings, my company's Wellings Capital. So our Wellings Income Fund 1 and 2 has been the best deal because of that. We're continually doing due diligence on great operators and trusting them with our money and our investors' money. And some of the deals in there, I mean, one of them just closed. And though this may sound hard to believe, this particular deal that just closed had a 580% profit, and that's return on equity. And before you guys accuse me of being a scammer or a crazy guy, I'll just tell you what happened is, in summary, it was bought from a mom and pop operator because the company was in chaos. The parents had passed away. The kids didn't know how to operate the large self-storage facility. It was acquired for $2.4 million cash. Using the value formula, it was appraised for $4.6 million about less than 6 months later, because that's what it should have been operating at once it was professionally managed. And then the debt, 43% debt was taken on that. That's $2 million in debt on a $4.6 million property. 18 months later, it was sold for that same number, $4.6 million. And so there was only $400,000 in cash in that. And of course, $400,000 turned into $2.6 million. The difference between the sale price and the debt is quite a nice return.
Yeah, that's awesome. And what would you say is the worst real estate deal that you've done?
Well, Mark, I've got a podcast called How to Lose Money. So trust me, I've got a long list of that. How many hours do you have?
Maybe just share one of your good ones.
A notable one was we bought a 125-unit multifamily in Lexington, Kentucky. And though I know this isn't true of all older multifamily, I was warned by my mentor. I don't think he said that much about it until after we closed, although he says he did, that, you know, a property older than 1980 or 1978 often has a lot of inherent environmental issues with it or issues in the infrastructure like wrought iron pipes running underground that fail. Well, in this 19-building multifamily, the pipes in one of the buildings failed, and it ended up costing us $107,000 to fix. And we were warned. Now, that was probably more because it was an emergency repair. It was definitely more than it needed to be. But even if it was half that, $50,000, let's say, if we had to do that across all 19 buildings, we would have been sunk, completely sunk. So it was quite, it used up a lot of our working capital, our reserves, our money we had set aside for value add projects. And frankly, based on that and some other things that happened, including neighboring communities who had significantly upgraded but not gotten the rent increases they expected and therefore kept the whole area down for some reason, we were in quite a quandary with that. And we ended up selling that about 2 years later, and we sold it for a profit. But honestly, with all the money we put into it and everything else, the investors, including ourselves, of course, only got back 80-something percent of what we put in. So it was a huge disappointment for all of us. But it could have been worse.
Yeah, yeah. What did you learn from that moving forward? I mean, did you kind of change your criteria and you're only doing newer vintage stuff? Or did you investigate insurance policy for that type of piping? Or what's the number one lesson that you learned?
Number one lesson was that was a 1961 apartment complex. So right now, I mean, that would have been almost 60 years old. This was years ago, but it was 50 something years old. So I would recommend people buy anything before about 1980 or even 78 with great, great caution. I, in fact, would not want to invest in older buildings again.
So, Paul, we're almost out of time, but just one final question. If someone were interested in learning about your funds and kind of the strategy behind those funds, could you just give maybe a quick overview and then help people kind of point them in the right direction for learning more about what you guys are doing these days?
Yeah, so absolutely. The Wellings Capital's fund, we're built on a platform of investing in recession-resistant assets through first-class, best-in-class operators, and mainly focusing on self-storage and mobile home parks, though multifamily is part of that when we can find deals that make sense. And we provide diversification across these asset types, geographies, operators, and time. And when I say time, I mean sometimes people are, let's say they're investing in December 2020, they might be investing, getting part of a portfolio that's actually been operated since, let's say, 2019. And so many of these assets in the portfolio are already significantly stabilized. They're operationally, they're already like the one I mentioned earlier. They're acquired at $2.4 million, but now they're worth $4.6 million. So somebody getting in right now is getting into assets that are already largely improved upon. And so that is what we do. People can learn more about us. They can visit me all over Bigger Pockets, or they can visit us at wellingscapital.com to learn more.
Awesome. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it. Thank you for being here and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, Mark. It was really an honor to be here.
Hey, everybody. It's Mark Allen Kenny. If you're interested in apartment building investments, schedule a call with me so we can have a chance to chat. My company is focused on growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. So let's hop on a quick call and talk about your investment goals and see if we're a good fit. Find out more at stellarinvestmentgroup.com.